some updates at the defense conference. We did okay. We're recording here, so we did some updates at the defense conference. But there have been quite a number of substantial changes and developments here, even since the defense conference, which was only what, 2 months, 2 months ago. So we're going to get started on this. Follow me on the outline here. If you have the opportunity to print your outline that we sent out via PDF, then please do that. The IRS. Bottom line here is the IRS is panicking. Actually, this is the top line, not the bottom line. The introduction here is that the IRS is panicking over bogus ERC claims. And when I say bogus, I'm talking about claims that just simply don't qualify under the statute for ERC credit, employee retention credit benefits. And these are substantial benefits. This is a substantial government giveaway program. They appropriated almost $100 billion to ERC to be given out to employers whose either businesses were either shut down by government COVID shutdown orders, or lost a substantial portion of their revenue. And depending on what period of time we're talking about, the revenue loss changed. It went from 50% to 20%. And this depends on the particular period in question. We're not going to get into all that today. We're only going to talk very specifically about the changes that have occurred here over the last couple of months, very significant changes. Now, there's been a progression in news releases that were issued by the IRS starting last summer that show how the intensity of this problem from their perspective has been rising here. In July of 2023, they issued a news release that was expressing concerns about national marketing firms causing businesses to sign up for or claim ERC credits that weren't allowed to make the claim. And the IRS has been blaming national marketing firms for this, not necessarily tax professionals that know what they're doing. They're tying this to national marketing firms that are inducing businesses to file dubious claims. In September of 2023, a second news release was announced, was issued, where the IRS announced a moratorium on processing ERC claims through at least the end of 2023. Notice the words, at least the end. All right. So we are under the processing moratorium right now, and we are going to remain under that processing moratorium through at least the rest of this week. They have not, to my knowledge, issued another announcement concerning the moratorium. However, there were further announcements that were released. We're going to get into those in just a second here. In connection with addressing the announcing the moratorium, Danny Werfel, IRS commissioner, specifically said the IRS is increasingly alarmed about honest small business owners being scammed by unscrupulous actors, namely national marketing firms, and we can no longer tolerate the growing evidence of questionable claims pouring in. He says businesses should seek out, and this should come as good news to us, businesses should seek out a trusted tax professional who actually understands the complex ERC rules, not a promoter or marketer hustling to get a hefty contingency fee. All right. And in that news release, again, this was September of 2023, that news release says that their processing time is going to increase by about 180 days. So they were slowing down the process of approving these claims and getting the checks out the door. And that's where we're at right now. The process is being dragged out. They're looking at these things a lot more closely. They're concerned about a number of things. We'll talk about those things very generally here as we go on. Then on October 19th, our wedding, Gene and I's wedding anniversary, October 19th, the IRS issued yet another news release authorizing or announcing ERC withdrawal procedures. And so these are procedures that allow businesses to actually withdraw their ERC claim before the IRS audits it, before the IRS issues a refund with respect to it. Now, I'm going to talk about those withdrawal procedures very specifically here. That's one of the things we're going to cover in this particular program here today. I'm going to go in detail through the withdrawal procedures. Again, Commissioner Werfel says the IRS is committed to helping small businesses and others caught up in the onslaught of employee retention credit marketing. The aggressive marketing of these schemes has harmed well-meaning businesses and organizations, and some are having second thoughts about their claims. We want to give these taxpayers a way out. And so this is what the withdrawal procedure is all about. If there is a business that realizes in retrospect that they don't qualify for the claim for any number of reasons, that claim can be withdrawn under certain circumstances, and no harm, no foul is the concept with respect to this withdrawal procedure. Then on December 6th, the IRS issued yet another news release. All right, and in this particular news release, it announced that an initial round of 20,000 letters has been mailed out to businesses announcing that they have disallowed that particular business's ERC claims. All right, they say that 20,000 letters have gone out, and they further state that they're on the verge of sending out another 20,000 letters. So almost, so 440,000 notices to businesses concerning their ERC claims. Now, this first round of 20,000 letters focused specifically on just two problem areas that the IRS has identified. And these, friends, are two of the six areas that I identified as likely audit issues in connection with ERC claims. If you go back and look at my newsletter of November of 2023, last month's newsletter, November of 2023, I have an article in there by the same title as this outline that the IRS is panicking over ERC claims. I identify what the likely audit areas are in that article. And this is two of those areas that I identified. Number one is that the entity was not even in existence during eligible claim periods. All right. One of the things that I pointed out is that you have to have a business engaged in for profit in order to claim the ERC claims and the ERC credit. And so I made the claim that the IRS is going to be looking at the Section 183 rules. Now, I haven't seen one of these letters. I don't know if they raise a Section 183 in particular, but they are making the claim that a certain number of businesses were not even in existence as an entity engaged in for profit during the claim periods. Now, remember, the claim periods, friends, are basically either six or seven periods, all three periods in 2020. So second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter of 2020, and then first, second, and third quarter of 2021, and fourth quarter of 2021, if you qualify as a substantially financially distressed business. And that's a unique definition. It's a term of art that's defined in section 3431 of the Internal Revenue Code, or is it 3134? I forget, whatever the ERC code section is defines what a financially distressed business is. And if you meet that definition, then you can claim the credit in the fourth quarter of 2021 also. Otherwise, if you don't meet that definition, you only get three quarters of 2021, first, second, and third. All right, so we got six quarters, second, third, and fourth of 2020, first, second, and third of 2021, and potentially the fourth quarter of 2021. You had to be a business in existence, engaged in an activity for profit in order to qualify. And then the second thing that these first 20,000 letters are talking about here, the second thing they're talking about is no paid employees during the eligible claim periods. You had to have people on the payroll, friends, in order to qualify for the employee retention credit. The employee retention credit is based on the employment taxes paid by the employer to employees on the payroll during that period of time. Now, these employees didn't necessarily have to be working. All right, the company could have laid off certain employees, but they still had to be on the payroll. You had to be actually paying them. So we are seeing evidence, or at least the IRS has seen evidence, and these first round of 20,000 letters indicates that they see this evidence here of these businesses that are making these claims that either did not have employees at all, no paid employees during the eligibility period, or not in existence. All right, now, The decision The decision is subject to administrative appeal. In other words, if the employer receives the IRS's determination letter that says you're not eligible for the claim, that is subject to administrative appeal, right? It's not a final determination that the employee is stuck with, or employer, I should say, is stuck with. You have the right to appeal that decision. And Werfel made the claim in this news release. Now we're talking about the December 6th news release. Werfel made the claim that audit and criminal investigative work is extensive and ongoing. And Werfel made the claim that there's thousands of civil audits that are being teed up and hundreds of cases that are being referred to DOJ for investigation and prosecution in connection with deliberately false ERC claims, as opposed to ERC claims that were made in good faith, but just simply don't qualify for one reason or another. Now, one of the things that the IRS has expressed concern with is this issue regarding supply chain arguments. All right. This was mentioned in a chief counsel advice memo that was issued back in July of 2023. The IRS made the claim in one of its notice announcements way back in 2020. This is notice, I'm sorry, 2021. This is notice 2021-20, which has a Q&A section in there on various businesses that are allowed to claim the ERC and those that are not. This is section 3D of that particular memo, talks about supply chain issues. And this is what's coming up as a recurring theme in these various news releases that I just went through, the three or four of them, is these apparent supply chain claims. Now, here's what's going on. In this particular Q&A section, again, way back in 2021, the IRS says that an employer may be considered to have a full or partial suspension of operations due to a government shutdown order if, under the facts and circumstances, the business's suppliers are unable to make deliveries of critical goods or materials due to a governmental order that causes the supplier to suspend its operations. So business is affected as a result of a supplier having a government shutdown order that affects the supplies the business needs to operate. All right, if the fact, I'm going on here now, if the facts and circumstances indicate that the business's operations are fully or partially suspended as a result of the inability to obtain critical goods or materials from its suppliers because the suppliers were required to suspend operations, then the business would be considered an eligible employer for calendar quarters during which its operations are fully or partially suspended and may be eligible to receive the employee retention credit. So this statement in that Q&A section of notice 2021-20 is what has unleashed the tide here of claims that any business connected with a supplier who was shut down is somehow eligible for the employee retention credit. So these are the supply chain issues that have come up here. So now we've got a situation where the IRS issues this chief counsel advice memo in July of 2023. So, you know, almost over 2 years after that initial report was issued, the IRS comes up with this chief counsel advice memo to clarify this. In the chief counsel advice memo, the IRS lays out five different potential scenarios under which a business may have supply chain issues. All right. So these five different scenarios basically break down all the various scenarios that could apply. I couldn't think of one that wasn't covered by the chief counsel advice in the five different scenarios. I'm not saying there isn't another potential scenario, but I couldn't think of one. It looked to me like they had all the bases covered here with those five different examples. But under those five different examples, only one example qualified as a business able to claim the employee retention credit because a supplier was shut down by a government order of some kind. And so basically what happened in the facts and circumstances of that particular situation is that that shutdown order caused a supplier to suspend operations. All right. So a government shutdown order caused a supplier to suspend operations. The inability to obtain that supplier's goods and materials caused a suspension of the employer's operations. So there's a direct connection between the supplier's goods and materials and the employer in question and their business operations. And the employer was unable to obtain goods and materials from an alternative source. In that situation, the shutdown of a supplier's operations led to a shutdown of the business's operations, which in turn made the business eligible for the ERC, even though the shutdown order wasn't directly specifically pointed at that business. Now, here's the key, and you'll see this when you read the chief counsel memo, is the supply chain connection has to have the direct impact on the employer's operations of shutting them down. So the other four scenarios involved the business finding another source of supply, albeit more expensive, or the business had enough of that supplier's materials in their warehouses and inventory that they could continue to operate, or the business was able to replace that particular product or product that was in their supply chain was something that was suitable that allowed them to continue to operate. So all of these other scenarios involve the employer continuing to be able to operate, even though they might have had additional expenses, or they had to zig or zag in ways they might not have wanted to, or they had to use up their inventory, which they were using as a fallback inventory, whatever the alternatives were. Only in this one scenario where the supplier's operations suspended the employer's operations was the ERC available to the employer, despite the fact that it was not directly and very specifically shut down by a government shutdown order. And so this is something that needs to be looked at in your, assuming that you get some of these audit cases that are starting to come out, is did that business have supply chain operations, operation disruptions, and were those disruptions such that the business could not function? That is something that the IRS is going to be looking at very, very specifically here. So I very strongly encourage you to read that chief counsel advice memo. It is very easy to find, and I've got the citation for you. And of course, typical with all of my outlines, I've got the citations for all of this stuff that I'm referring to right in the outline here. So if you're not sure about any of this stuff, use the outline and use the material cited there. All right, so now let's go on here and let's talk about the withdrawal procedures. The withdrawal procedures were identified in early December here, 2023-193. I'm sorry, that was issued October on my anniversary. The IRS always gives me these anniversary presents, and every once in a while they throw me a birthday present here too. But this is an anniversary present here, I guess, the withdrawal procedures. So what are these withdrawal procedures? As I said earlier, quoting Danny Werfel, the commissioner, he says, we want to give these businesses a way out. These businesses are the businesses that were sucked into claiming an employee retention credit by aggressive marketing, by national organizations, and the businesses didn't obviously have the expertise to know whether they actually qualified or not. They're relying not on tax professionals such as ourselves, but instead they're relying on a marketing company to tell them that they qualify, and maybe they don't. So the IRS has given these people an opportunity to basically withdraw their claim. Withdraw their claim is the operative language here. Now, there are four different criteria, or there are four different criteria that the business must meet in order to withdraw the claim. So all businesses seeking to withdraw a claim must meet all four of these requirements, all right? Number one, the claim was filed on an adjusted employment tax return. So in other words, the business filed an amended return, Form 941X, to claim the ERC. All right, the adjusted return was filed only to claim the ERC and for no other reason. So in other words, it's simply a refund claim based on employee retention credit. The business is expected to withdraw the entire amount of the claim. You can't partially withdraw the claim. And lastly, the business, the IRS has either not paid the claim, or the IRS has paid the claim, but the business has not cashed the check. So we're talking about two overarching criteria here for a withdrawal. Number one is the business is essentially conceding its entire ERC claim, not partial, but entirely. And number two, it hasn't been paid. And when I say it hasn't been paid, it either hasn't gotten the check or it hasn't negotiated the check that it did get. So the business doesn't have the money. The IRS still has the money. Now, here's the procedure for requesting withdrawal. And it depends on one of three potential scenarios. So let me identify the scenarios here, and then I'll go through the procedures for each one of the different scenarios. The first scenario is the business hasn't received a refund and has not been notified of an audit. So its claim is just sitting there. No audit notice, no refund received. Number two, business hasn't received a refund but has been notified of an audit. No refund, but audit is in the mix. And number three, business did receive a refund, but hasn't cashed the check, nor has it deposited the check. In other words, it hasn't negotiated the check in any way. So it has the check in hand, but it has not negotiated the check. So now let's go through the procedures as they relate to each one of these individual scenarios. All right, number one, no refund and no audit notice. In this situation, you've got a business that no longer qualifies, that doesn't qualify, not no longer. They didn't qualify in the first place, but they haven't received their refund and they haven't been notified of an audit. This business is going to fax a withdrawal request to the IRS. The request form itself, the withdrawal form itself, is a copy of the 941X that they filed in the first place. So you're using the actual tax return that was filed with the IRS to claim the ERC. This is the form you use to withdraw the ERC claim. In the left margin, in large letters, you write the word withdrawn. Large letters in the left margin, write the word withdrawn. Then in the right margin, the authorized person has to sign and date that form and then print their title, print their name and title. Now, the authorized person is any person who can bind the company as to financial or legal decisions. Think of the authorized person as a responsible officer for purposes of the trust fund recovery penalty. Who has the authority in the business to bind the business with respect to financial decisions? Who has the authority in the business to dispose of company assets, all right? That's a responsible officer for purposes of a trust fund recovery penalty. It's the authorized person for purposes of withdrawing the employee retention credit. So in the left margin, we're going to write the word withdrawn. In the right margin, you're going to write that person signs it, dates it, prints his name and title. All right, then you fax the withdrawal into the IRS. I got the fax number in the outline right there. That's the fax number. You're going to fax that withdrawal request directly to the IRS at that fax number. That's a specific number they established expressly for the purposes of receiving these withdrawals. All right, so that's where it goes. I strongly recommend you include a cover letter with the name and EIN of the business, the authorized person's contact information, and you have to follow this procedure for each and every quarter in which you are withdrawing the claim. So if you filed three claims or four or six, then that's the number of withdrawals you have to send in. You cannot send in a blanket withdrawal. It's got to be done on a quarter by quarter basis. And again, the starting point for making this withdrawal is a copy of the adjusted return that you filed in the first place. That's essentially the withdrawal form that we're using. Now let's go on to number two. The company didn't receive a refund, but received an audit notice. This company now knows they are under examination. They have not gotten their money back. In this situation, you're going to prepare with the withdrawal exactly as I explained above. So the 941X is the withdrawal form. But we're not faxing it to the IRS. You're not faxing it in to that central fax number that I gave you up here. Instead, we're going to deal directly with the examiner in this particular situation. If an examiner has been assigned to the case, you're going to communicate directly with the examiner that you wish to withdraw the claim. The examiner will give you instructions on what to do to withdraw the claim. If no examiner has been assigned, then you send the withdrawal per the instructions in the audit notice letter itself. All right, so even though your case has been assigned for audit, you still have the ability to withdraw that claim as long as the refund has not been issued. All right, that brings us up to scenario number three. Scenario number three is the IRS issued the check. They've issued the refund check, but the business has not negotiated the check. They haven't cashed it. They haven't deposited it. Again, step number one is to prepare the withdrawal request exactly as outlined above. All right, it's done on the Form 941, just as I indicated, with the comments in the left margin and the right margin, as outlined in the as set forth in the outline here above. In this particular case, you got to send the check back with the withdrawal form. All right, you write the word void on the check's endorsement space on the back. All right, where you would normally endorse it, you write the word void there. You mail the check, the cover letter, and the withdrawal form to the IRS at this special address that they have sent up, set up here for this purpose. This is the Cincinnati Refund Inquiry Unit. And so it's going to go to Cincinnati, Ohio. There's the address there on the outline. So you're going to do, again, you're going to do this for each individual quarter. Now, you know, obviously you don't have separate checks. The IRS has probably issued one check for all of the entire refund, or maybe they issued separate checks, I don't know. But the fact of the matter is the check has to go back. The check has to go back with the withdrawal forms, the Form 941X being withdrawn. Withdrawn, the check has to go back with that. Now, let's talk about the IRS's notification of the withdrawal. The IRS provides written notification whether the withdrawal is accepted. The withdrawal is not effective until it's accepted in writing. All right, so it is very important that you understand that the IRS still has to accept this withdrawal. All right, and you also have to keep in mind that if you're withdrawing this claim and you're no longer entitled to the employee retention credit, that income tax returns likely need to be amended if the withdrawal is accepted. So remember, when you file the ERC claim, if this was procedurally done correctly in the first place, when you filed that employee retention credit claim, you amended the company's income tax returns, or the company, I should say, should have amended their income tax returns to reflect a lower deduction, or in many cases, no deduction for employment taxes paid, because that's what the employee retention credit was all about, was giving the company a credit for employment taxes paid for employees who were kept on the payroll during government shutdown operations or when the business's income declined considerably. All right, so you claim the employee retention credit, or business claim the employee retention credit. That means their deduction for employment taxes went down. That means they had to amend their income tax return, which means that their income tax liability likely went up. So that's got to be reversed. All right, all of that has to be reversed if you're going to do with the if you're going to do the withdrawal here. Now, the IRS makes it perfectly clear here in this notice, this this October 19 notice, that businesses that willfully filed fraudulent claims or conspired to do so should be aware that withdrawing the fraudulent claim will not exempt them from potential criminal investigation or prosecution. Now, we're talking about willfulness here. Willfulness in the concept of any criminal case is a very hard, very high burden for the IRS to prove. They must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the taxpayer deliberately set out to evade or defeat the payment of a tax, that they deliberately violated a known legal duty. In other words, they knew what the requirements of the law were, and they took specific overt acts to defeat the payment of the tax in violation of the law. All right, that's a tall order, but it's not impossible to prove. It depends on the facts and circumstances of a specific situation. All right, so the IRS reminds us in this news release here that they are working thousands of ERC credit ERC audits, and that the IRS is working with it says DOR there. It should say DOJ. That should be DOJ, not DOR, DOJ, not DOR, on egregious ERC claims and promoters who have been ignoring the rules and pushing businesses to apply for credits that they're not entitled to. All right, now, let's talk about the moratorium for just a second, and then we're going to move on here and talk about the most recent release that was issued here. The moratorium and the statute of limitations. I said earlier that in September of 2023 is when the IRS issued the moratorium. And they stated, and by moratorium, we're talking about a processing moratorium. They are not processing ERC claims through the rest of this year. They anticipate that the processing time of ERC claims is going to be at least doubled from 90 to 180 days. They are no longer anxious to get money in the hands of businesses. Their philosophy back in 20 and 2021, when this day and 2022 even, is when these claims were made, we want to process these as soon as possible. These businesses are in trouble. They need a hand up off the mat here. The economic circumstances in the United States are dire. We need to get this money out to these businesses as soon as possible. That's no longer the attitude. The attitude now is we believe, and then this is the IRS talking, we believe that the further we get away from the COVID crisis itself, which was 2020 and 2021, really by all measures, some you know, residuals in 2022, but by all measures, it was 2020 and 2021. IRS believes the further we get away from that, now we're on the threshold of 2024, the less likely it is that businesses that are filing for the ERC claim are legitimately entitled to the claim. So they think that every day that goes by away from these tax years 2020 and 2021, the less likely it is that a business has a legitimate ERC claim. So this is why they are not anxious to process these claims anymore, which is why, as counsel, if you're going to continue to submit claims, which you can do because the statute of limitations is still open on some of these periods, you need to make triple sure that your business qualifies. And one of the things that you want to do is go back through the materials that we did at the defense conference in 2020. Let's see, we did some stuff in 2022 and 2023 on ERC claims. And I went through the progression of what the qualifications were. We got plenty of people in this organization and some of these people on this call right now that know this stuff inside and out. And so if you've got questions or problems, make sure that you tap into the experience and talent that this group has to help you figure out whether your client has a legitimate right to make that claim or not. So now let's talk about the moratorium and the statute of limitations. The September 14 decision to suspend ERC processing is purely administrative. This was not a court order shutting down processing. This was not a congressional action of any kind shutting down processing. This was the IRS issuing administrative determination saying, hold the bus, stop the presses. We need to start taking careful looks at this stuff. We're concerned about the legitimacy of a number of these claims, and we're going to take our time sorting through this stuff. So this decision in no way affects the statutory provisions of any code section. All right. This administrative decision does not trump any statutes or regulations whatsoever. So the statute of limitations on amended returns and refund claims is controlled 100% by statute. It is not controlled in any way, shape, or form by this moratorium. So you need to keep this in mind, that the moratorium that they have issued does not toll the refund statute of limitations concerning ERC or any other refund that your client may be entitled to for any reason in connection with employment taxes. This moratorium does not stop the statute of limitations clock from running. I just want to make that perfectly clear. It is not affected. The statute is not affected by these procedures. Now, let's go on here. And let's talk about a very, very important development here that happened on December 6th and December 21. All right, there was actually three announcements that came out here. First of all, in the December 6th announcement, which I talked about already, the IRS announced that it would be releasing the details of a voluntary disclosure program concerning employee retention credit later in the month. And then on December 21st, they issued news release 2023-247, and then on its heels, announcement 2024-3. So these two announcements came on December 21st in response to the December 6th announcement saying that they're going to issue a voluntary disclosure program. And so that's what I want to talk about right now is the voluntary disclosure program is applicable to claims that have been made. All right. Claims that have been, let me rephrase that. This is applicable to claims that have been paid by the IRS and where the business negotiated the check. They cashed the check. They deposited the check. They used the money that they received. So this is the distinguishing factor between the withdrawal program and the voluntary disclosure program. The withdrawal program involves claims that have not been paid, or if they were paid, where the business did not negotiate the check. Whereas the voluntary disclosure program applies to businesses that got paid, negotiated their check. So now let's talk about what the terms of this deal are, how this thing works. Under the voluntary disclosure program, first of all, generally speaking, this voluntary disclosure program is not much different than any other voluntary disclosure program that the IRS has ever operated. All right, they've got basically a standing practice of considering voluntary disclosures in any criminal case. They've had the offshore voluntary disclosure program that operated in three or four different phases over the course of about, 8 or 10 years or so, a number of years. And so the essence of voluntary disclosure remains the same in this program as it did in those programs. And I'm going to get into the details here as we proceed through this. First of all, the business has got to repay 80% of the money that was given to it under the employee retention credit. So if the business received a refund of $100,000, it's got to pay back 80 grand. What about the 20%? What's that all about? Well, the 20% is done the business is allowed to retain 20% of the refund to cover two things. Number one, their income tax liability. Because remember, they reduced their income tax or they increased their income tax liability by reducing their income tax deduction for employee for employment taxes paid when they did that credit claim. So this 20% covers part of that. And then it also is the IRS throwing businesses a bone that they recognize had to pay a commission to marketers to get their employee retention credit in the first place. So the IRS is conceding 20% of the ERC claim that was paid to the individual business. Now let's talk about participant eligibility, and this is where the disclosure program very, very closely follows existing voluntary disclosure rules. Number one, the business can't already be under criminal investigation. How do you know if your business is under criminal investigation? Well, you'd know that for sure if they were contacted by special agents or they received a letter from the IRS saying that the case has been referred to DOJ for investigation. But you don't always get those letters, and you're certainly not going to get a knock on the door from a special agent until the case has already been assigned for investigation. The way you check that, the best way to check that, the only way that I know of to check it in the front end like this is to get transcripts and to review your transcripts to see if there's a criminal investigation freeze code in the transcripts. That freeze code is TC-914. A TC-914 is a criminal freeze code. It stops any civil processing of any claim with respect to that tax module of any nature whatsoever. Refund, audit, anything is all frozen by the TC-914, which indicates a criminal investigation is pending and in the works. Number two, the business must not have received a third-party notice to the IRS of noncompliance. In other words, some whistleblower sending a letter to the IRS. I know that such and such a business is not entitled to an ERC claim. Here's why. So maybe a disgruntled employee or something like that. Nor has the IRS otherwise acquired information regarding noncompliance. So in other words, in order to be a voluntary disclosure, it has to be a disclosure to the IRS of wrongdoing in the first instance. It can't come on the heels of the IRS finding out through some other means that there is a violation of law here. Number three is there can be no employment tax audit pending for any periods covered by the application. So you can't seek voluntary disclosure after the IRS has notified you that you're under audit. You know, think of the bank robber walking out of the bank and the cop coming in the door as the bank robber is coming out the door, and the cop says, "Stop, you're under arrest." And the bank robber says, "How about if I just give you the money back and we call it even?" No, that's not how it works. And that's kind of the theory of the voluntary disclosure here. The IRS can't know that there was a voluntary, that there was a violation, and there can't be any audits going on, no prior notice, no demand for repayment of ERC, any of those things cannot have happened. And participants in this disclosure program can include third-party payers or professional payroll services. They do qualify for this. Now, let's talk about the terms of the program itself. Under the terms of the program, the participant must, first and foremost, concede non-eligibility for ERC. All right, you can't participate in voluntary disclosure, have the IRS concede criminal liability, and then come back and say, "Oh, you know, now that I've been absolved of any criminal liability, I want to argue that I'm entitled to 10 or 15 or 20 or 30% of my ERC claim." You got to concede non-eligibility. You're not entitled to anything in connection with this claim. You got to pay back 80% of the money that was received. And the IRS concedes interest on the ERC claim. All right, so you're not required to pay interest, and there's no interest on the 80% if it's paid in full before you sign a closing agreement. I'm going to talk about a closing agreement here in just a minute. That's one of the elements of the program that you have to sign. Interest applies if an installment agreement is set up. So you can get an installment agreement on the 80%, but you will pay interest on the installment agreement, and you have to qualify for the installment agreement just like any other business would. So that means full financial disclosure, financial statement, 433B, all of that stuff. All right, there is no interest if you pay the entire 80% on or before you sign the closing agreement. All right, so now, you're not required to amend income tax returns to adjust payroll deductions. So as I said before, the part of the 20% concession on the part of the IRS is you don't have to amend tax returns to decrease your income tax liability. If you no longer have the employee retention credit, now your deduction for employment taxes goes up, your income tax liability for the business goes down. You don't have to make that amendment to claim that reduction in income tax liability. That's part of what the 20% concession is on the part of the IRS. You have to, number five, you have to provide, the business has to provide the name and contact information of whoever advised them or assisted them in making the claim. They have to sign a closing agreement under Section 7121 of the Internal Revenue Code is a closing contract. It's just like an offer and compromise contract. 7122 is the offer and compromise contract. 7121 is the closing agreement. When you have a closing agreement signed by the IRS and the taxpayer, that resolves all civil and criminal matters permanently per the terms of the deal, can't be reopened by the IRS, can't be reopened by the taxpayer. So it is a final, ultimate, complete resolution of all disputes with respect to those particular tax periods. So your closing agreement is going to have to be signed. And then the final condition is that the IRS will not assess civil penalties related to the ERC claim if the 20% is full paid prior to signing the closing agreement. So that closing agreement is critical, and it is the point at which you avoid penalties and interest in connection with this thing if you can get this all paid prior to signing the closing agreement. Now let's talk procedures here specifically. How is this done? All right, number one is the application has to be submitted on a new IRS form. The IRS just came out with, and I did another search for this form on Friday before we left the office for the Christmas break, and the form, to my knowledge, still has not actually been released. So I have not seen the forms or instructions, but it's going to be out there any minute. There's no doubt about it if it's not out there this week, which I admittedly, I have to say, I didn't check before I started the conference here today. But we know what the form is. It's Form 15-434. It's called an application for employee retention for ERC, voluntary disclosure program. And it comes with a set of instructions, obviously. And so the application has to be submitted on that form in accordance with the instructions. So that's number one, signed under penalty of perjury. And there is a drop dead date as of this time. The drop dead date is before midnight local time on March 22nd. Now, depending on how successful this is, and depending on how many people apply and how much money the IRS collects, I would not be surprised to see them extend that date. Yeah, some of you may think back to the offshore voluntary disclosure program. I think that was extended 3 or 4 times over the life of that program before they finally pulled the plug on it, as fewer and fewer people were applying on the extended dates. And so the IRS believed, well, we've got all we're going to get out of people that admit they make a mistake, and you know, anybody else is going to be in hiding here. So I can't tell you that it will be extended. There is no evidence right now that leads me to believe that it will be extended. Everything the IRS is telling us in the December news release is that this is the deadline. So you got to mark this in your calendar, friends. And as far as your communication with your clients is concerned, this is the deadline they need to know about. All right, March 22nd is it. The payment has to be made on EFTPS. Remember, it's the 80% settlement amount. You got to do each tax period separately. All right. Each tax period has to be paid separately. All right. An installment agreement is available if full payment is not possible. But under that scenario, the installment agreement is an application process. The IRS is not going to automatically grant an installment agreement to a business under this program any faster than they would under any other delinquency, right? So that means the business has got to submit the 433B, all the supporting financial information, and its argument for the installment agreement of X dollars per month, all right? The IRS is going to prepare the closing agreement. The agreement must be signed and returned within 10 days of the date that they submit this thing to you, okay? So this is a pretty short fuse here. So remember, we're talking about 80% of the liability. So the best case scenario for the client is to pay that 80% on or before the deadline of the closing agreement, the signing of the closing agreement, which is, you know, a short fuse. This is the way they avoid penalties. This is the way they avoid interest. All right. Now, in connection with other matters, the IRS has the authority to deny the request. All right. They can deny the request, and the denial is not appealable. It's an administrative decision by the IRS that's made within their discretion, and it is not appealable. They do not have to accept a voluntary disclosure application from any particular taxpayer, and they will not accept a voluntary disclosure application if the taxpayer does not meet all of these criteria here that we've just gone through, that I've just walked you through. All right. Now, executing a closing agreement does not provide immunity from prosecution, which seems odd because that is what the nature of a closing agreement is. But they write that in the deal here, that it doesn't make you immune from prosecution. If somehow the IRS can prove beyond a reasonable doubt this element of willfulness, prosecution is a risk. I will tell you this, that as a practical matter, if they accept a voluntary disclosure program and enter into an installment agreement, I find it extremely difficult to believe that they would come back behind that and start a criminal prosecution. I believe that they would have difficulty in a burden of proof situation. Maybe Matt can comment on that when we go to the question section here. All right, so I am going to wrap this up and entertain questions here, but I do want to make one final point, and that is the key difference between the withdrawal program and the voluntary disclosure program. The key difference between these two programs is under the withdrawal program, the business either has not received payment or has not negotiated the check that they did receive. And this allows essentially the business to withdraw that claim with essentially no questions asked. Even if the claim is assigned for audit, the business still has the opportunity to withdraw that claim by just simply sending the withdrawal form to the auditor and saying, "Hey, we withdraw. Here's our check back. If you did get a check, and if you didn't get a check, then it's no issue." And then you just concede that you have no right to the employee retention credit for the periods in question. Whereas the voluntary disclosure program, under that scenario, the business got paid. And now the business is paying back 80% of that claim to the IRS in exchange for these various concessions that the business makes that they're not entitled, and so on and so forth. So on the one hand, the business did not get the money. That's the withdrawal. On the other hand, the business did get the money. That's the voluntary disclosure program. The difference is no harm, no foul with respect to the withdrawal program. All right, so that concludes my formal presentation. Gene, we can go ahead and open this up for questions here now. So you can write a question in the chat, or what I would rather encourage you to do is raise your hand and let Gene unmute you, and then you can comment. And what I would like to do is lean on Mac first. Mac, if you would comment, if you can, just maybe even just off the top of your head, if you haven't had a chance to review this initiative here. Off the top of your head, what your reaction is to this idea that signing a closing agreement does not necessarily provide immunity from prosecution. What's your reaction to that?
I agree that it does not provide immunity.
Okay.
And they've made, I thought they had made clear in their notice that, from what I had read about the notice, that there's no promise of no prosecution.
Right. No, I agree with that. I agree with that. But I guess my question to you is, wouldn't they have a difficult time with the willfulness issue if the company gets a closing agreement from the IRS and pays back the money?
No, that's like tax. Well, let me ask you, tax evasion. The guy evades $1 million in tax, and then he pays it back. Is that
Well,
gonna?
yeah, well, yeah, under normal circumstances, I would agree with you. It's like the robber walking out of the bank and gets stopped by the cop at the door. But under this circumstance, I'm following IRS specific procedures and entering into a closing agreement to say, okay,
But what's the difference between that and paying it back on your own?
Well, the difference is the IRS created the program to allow me to do it.
No, but that no, there is no difference, because the program the IRS prepared for us does not say that you cannot be prosecuted. Then, in effect, you're granted immunity if you go forward with the program.
Okay.
Unlike, by the way, unlike other voluntary, the offshore voluntary disclosure program.
All right, let me say this, Mac. Let me. Somebody's got to. Somebody's got to. Somebody's talking there, and we're getting some feedback. And I think it's Gene. You got to mute yourself, Gene, because we're hearing a phone call or something. So, okay, go ahead, Mac. Go ahead and say
Okay, I
what.
was saying this is unlike one of the many offshore. Wait a minute. Maybe that's. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Mac. You keep talking.
Okay. Call you back. That was my phone.
All right.
Okay. If you recall, years ago, they had numerous voluntary disclosure programs for the offshore initiative, they called it.
Right.
And initially, they were granting immunity from prosecution if you came in under the program. And then they changed it. It went on for so many years, and then they said, no, we're not going to give you immunity. So that is like this present program. That is, if there's no specific grant of immunity from prosecution, then they can prosecute you.
Okay. All right. So what that means is that as counsel, we've got to carefully evaluate here what the situation is, what the circumstances are, in making the decision to apply to this program, because you're essentially telling the IRS that you don't qualify. So, that is, does that
Well,
cause?
it's a catch 22
Right.
because of the numbers involved here, maybe you won't be selected for further scrutiny, or certainly not selected for criminal prosecution. Whereas if you come in early under this program and make yourself known, maybe you put a target on your back and you're prosecuted. And
Sure,
that's the
sure.
risk. And so okay, Dan, now the question to you is, so what do you advise the client? Given that.
Well, I think it's a facts and circumstances test, Mac. First thing I want to know is how did the client get to the point where they made their claim? Did they do it on their own? Did they rely on some counsel? Did they rely on a marketing company? I think if I got a client that relied entirely on a marketing company, didn't do it themselves, and simply did what they were told by some marketing hotshot that held themselves out as some kind of expert, I think that person would not be a good candidate for a criminal prosecution, and I think that person should do the should do the disclosure the initiative. The disclosure initiative. That'd be my gut reaction. On the other hand, if I had a client that did it themselves and they just said, yeah, this looks like free money to me, and they didn't do any evaluation, they didn't do an analysis, they didn't get counsel, and they just filed some forms because they thought they were going to get free money, I think that's a danger.
Okay, but wait, you're mixing apples and oranges because you first said marketing program. A marketing program ain't counsel. So I think if a guy just came in under a marketing program but did not hire counsel, he's still greater,
Hey,
higher
are
on
you
the list
doing?
for criminal
No,
prosecution.
I disagree with
going
that.
out golfing? No.
I disagree with that, and I'll tell you why.
Oh, you're going top
I
golf now.
disagree. Okay, guys, please
Oh,
mute
to
your
golf up
phones.
there in the
Please mute
snow.
your phones while Mac and I talk through this.
We look at
We're going
you.
to entertain
100%,
everybody's
right?
opinion, and
Well,
that's
good for
fine, but we
you.
can't talk over each other.
With the
Check,
grand.
check. You have to
Oh, that's
mute
great.
your phone.
Have a
Check,
good day.
check. Please mute your phone. So, Mac, I'll tell you what the difference is, in my opinion. Now, this is just. I'm just more or less shooting from the hip here based on everything I've read. Everything I read in these news releases that the IRS has sent out, and there's been five of them now, I think, they all say that honest companies are being taken advantage of by marketing hustlers who are encouraging businesses who don't qualify to make the claim solely so they can get it, so the marketing company can get a commission. And these businesses don't understand because this is a very, very complicated area of law. Werfel said that over and over again throughout all of these reports. So if I've got a company that relied on a marketing firm, not counsel, but a marketing firm, and they just simply did what the marketing firm said they were allowed to do, I think it's unlikely that that person's going to be prosecuted.
I think it's helpful, and I think you might be right as to unlikely, but still, we're back to what do you advise the client? And it's still a sticky widget because all this talk by IRS is not a defense.
Yeah.
It's just talk. It's you guys, we know a bunch have been defrauded. Well, let's say a guy's an astute businessman, and he's used counsel for other matters. But in this case, he listens to a marketing guy and doesn't call his counsel. I think that guy's got a serious problem.
Yeah, and
It's
I
a lack
agree
of
with that, and
oldness.
that's why we got to look at this on a case by case basis.
Right.
All right, so let's so if anybody else got questions or comments, go ahead and raise your hand. Gene can unmute you. Larry has raised his hand, so Gene, please unmute Larry, or Larry, unmute yourself.
Okay. Hey guys. Is anybody else out there doing ERC work on a contingent basis?
Who's doing ERC work on a contingent basis? We've
Not
do
me, but because under Circular 230, it doesn't look like you can do that. And I think what these other companies are is they are not practicing as a CPA, EA, or law firm. They're just a regular Inc., just a business. Because just like the tax preparers, unlicensed tax preparers are not subject to 230. So ironically, the IRS allows, or the perhaps the lowest educated, least trained class of preparers are the ones that are able to make a lot of money on this. And those of us that are, licensed, we can't do that unless you set up a separate company. Anybody else look into this? Mr. Klitzner?
Well, I don't know why under Circular 230 you can't make a claim for a refund on a contingency basis.
Because you can't on an amended return, something like unless it's done within 12 months of when an audit notice went out or something like that. I don't have it in front of me, but
Yeah, I don't have it in front of me either. Well, it's something we
all of
should
the
look at.
CPA firms that we work with that have done it for other clients
have all been CPA firms.
Yeah, but they're not doing contingency basis, are they?
Oh, yeah, 15%.
Yeah, I don't see how Circular 230, yeah, if you want to go to someone else, I could pull it up real quick maybe and read it, but I don't see how 230 allows you to do it.
Even KMP, which is a large, you know, big four, did it for one of my nine nonprofit clients. You know, they did it as a CPA firm. They didn't do it as an audit firm. You know, their CPA part of it took. So I've never seen that applied. Let me put it in that case, because there's just too many CPA firms out there that are doing them.
Dan?
Dan?
Looks like James. Taylor has a question.
Okay, Larry, are you done?
Yeah, I'll bring it up if I find it real quick.
All right, good. Cool. So who's got the next question? Go
James,
ahead.
James, you need to unmute and you can go ahead and ask.
Yeah. Does anyone, first of all, I agree with Larry. I think Circular 230, the key point of that contingent fees is it has to be something subject to a government decision. And I don't think that would fall under that. But I had another question also. Dan, are you aware of, is there a list, or does the IRS contemplate compiling a list of some of these, what I call fly-by-night marketing operators out there?
If they handle the ERC the way they handle the offer and compromise, everybody's going to be considered fly by night, including us. Remember that in the summer of 2022, Taxpayer Defense Institute, TFI, filed a complaint with the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration against then Commissioner Charles Rettig because of Rettig's comments in a number of news releases that everybody that was making an offer and compromise, that was offering compromise work to the public, was a offer mill that was scamming the public.
Oh yeah.
And that people could make their best deal. You can make your best deal by just calling the IRS and dealing with an IRS assister over the phone. So we filed a 12, 15 page complaint against the commissioner, which, by the way, just for the record, and Steve Plitzner, you're on with us, I did not receive so much as an acknowledgement letter from TIGDA.
I was going to ask.
Acknowledging our complaint against the commissioner.
If I could follow up.
And I'm sure they said to themselves, he's not the commissioner anymore. What difference does it make? But anyway, my point, James, in answer to your question, is they're just going to treat everybody as a fly-by-night.
Oh, okay. Well, because I've got some clients that did this, and from my limited knowledge of these people doing this, I'm not aware of too many CPAs doing it or just tax professionals. These people seem to have emerged out of the woodwork. You know, get your fast, quick money here. And I could see why. I believe there's going to be a lot of these companies. I'm not aware of many of them being tax professionals. I know I briefly looked into it, and I said, no, it took me about 10 minutes to just, I said, that's just too much liability.
Well, there's going to be prosecutions. There's no question about that. And, remains to be seen who gets prosecuted. Chris, go ahead. Did you add your hand up?
Chris, yeah, when they did the moratorium back in September, I originally understood that they were, putting a stop to all the new claims, processing any new claims that came in after that. But the older ones that they never got around to, they were still going to slowly go through those. But I don't know of anybody who's gotten a check since then. And I was curious with the group, first off, you know, have they had any clients get any money since September? You know,
anybody else?
Yeah, I haven't seen anybody. So I'm assuming they applied it to, you know, just stopping all claims.
I think from how I read these reports, these news releases, that they were shutting down all processing and. Yeah.
Because Kaylee's called Taxpayers Advocate several times,
yeah,
trying to follow up, and yeah, they won't even talk to her anymore.
They use the phrase in one of these reports, I forget which one it was, is guardrails. We got to put up guardrails. We're not going to start processing these things until we got guardrails in place.
Right.
So
it sounds like it's going to affect old claim as well as the new ones.
I think so. Yeah. All right. Anybody else? Jim, you got your hand up. Go ahead and unmute yourself. Chris, please mute yourself again.
Thank you.
Jim Olson, go ahead. Gene, can you unmute Jim?
I can. And while I'm at it, let's see, am I unmuted? Where am I?
You're unmuted. You got to unmute.
I found it. Sorry, guys. I couldn't find the mute button. Hi, everybody. A couple of comments from me. Having been the voluntary disclosure coordinator for CI for about 15 years, it's always been the policy in any voluntary disclosure, quote, policy, no guarantees, no promise that there'll be no criminal investigation. As long as you provide complete and truthful information and we don't find out down the road that you were giving us half-truths and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Full disclosure.
Exactly. Max, absolutely right. You know, representing somebody, you can never give them an absolute guarantee. The IRS always holds that little trump card, you know, that, you know, we do not promise no criminal investigation, but as a policy, and of course, I have not seen everything, nowhere near, but I never once saw an instance where somebody came in the door and gave us complete truthful information that, you know, they were not criminally prosecuted. They got crushed civilly, obviously. Not criminally. Another question.
Let me respond to one of those points that you just made.
Go ahead.
Got crushed civilly. That absolutely was true with the offshore stuff. It was just massive penalties. The good news in this program is they're waiving interest in penalties.
Yes.
And 20% of the credit. So it seems like comparatively like a pretty good offer.
Yeah, I agree. But they always are going to throw that caveat in there that this is not a guarantee we will not criminally prosecute. They always got to leave that open for that oddball situation where, you know, something came up or, you know, whatever. Second question, we focused on the basic qualifiers for this. And I'm helping out some people that got involved with some of these fly-by-night companies. Never filed the amended returns. It totally ignored the PPP payments. Do we see them digging into the weeds when they do the audits, or do we think they're just going to hit those high base questions on do you qualify, or do we see them going into the weeds and determining, you know, because you can't use the same wages for
it. I fully expect them, Jim. That's a good question. I fully expect them to go deep in the weeds on this stuff. And remember, I identified six potential audit issues that I thought on reflection that they're going to look at. And PPP is one of them, man. You can't claim the same wages for PPP as you do for the ERC. You cannot double up. And I think that's one of the key things they're going to be looking at. One of the six things that occurred to me. And we already got the two things on the list here that they sent out 20,000 letters on. Which I identified, you know, an entity not in existence for purposes of earning income and no paid employees during that period in question. So, you know, that's just right off the bat that the question of in business to earn income, that's certainly getting in the weeds. And yes, the answer is yes. They're going in the weeds on this stuff.
Okay. I mean, that's just the easy stuff. If you weren't in business and you have no employees, I mean, that almost should come across CI's desk. I mean, are you kidding me?
You think, depending on the scope of the claim.
The amount of the claim, exactly right. Now, one other question.
My question to you, Jim, let me interrupt and ask this question of you. Do you have a sense for what the prosecutorial threshold might be in cases like this, where below the line, they're not going to bother with CI, above the line, it's a no-brainer, or not necessarily a no-brainer, but that's something they're definitely going to look at. Do you have a sense of what that line might be?
Well, part nine of the criminal investigation manual, the law enforcement manual, was always 40,000 or more over a 3-year period. Now, that may have gone up. I'm going to assume, and once again, that depends on where you're at. That's going to be a huge, way different in Los Angeles or New York than it will be in, pick some small town,
Yeah,
Duluth, Minnesota, or something.
Central Missouri, sure.
It just is, because they got limited resources. And it sounds to me they're going to be overwhelmed with this stuff. Sounds to me all they got to do is pick maybe 10 or 15 of these large marketing companies, get their client list, which will be thousands of these things, where we all know that they didn't ask any of the right questions. They're just looking for a contingency fee, and most of them have disappeared. I just wonder how they're going to get to all these. Now, they have extended the statutes. I believe that's correct. Isn't it like a 5 or a 5-year
It's a 5-year
statute?
statute now. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, I mean, that's makes a difference, and
And
that
that's
brings up
still.
interesting questions on, I know they give you 20%, well, that's voluntary disclosure though. If you don't voluntarily disclose, what if the statutes are gone on those returns that you paid that tax on that, when you grossed up your wages for the amount of money you got, and yet they come to you 5 years later and disallow it,
That's
you're
it's gonna it's gonna it's
what do
gonna
you do?
it's gonna be catastrophic for businesses, no question about it.
Right. And
Because
one more question that we got
now it's
lots of
full
people with.
tax plus interest plus penalties
Right. You had mentioned that.
and potentially a fraud penalty.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, right. Now, you had mentioned that you thought you should amend the returns and pay the tax when you file the 941s. I don't know if I agree with that.
No, I'm
Because
not
what if
sure I
I
said
never
that.
get
Wait,
the
wait a minute.
money?
Amend the returns and pay the tax. No. What is the context, Jim? When I'm talking about the withdrawal program, you don't have to amend any returns.
No.
All
I'm talking
programs,
about
you pull the
just.
returns, you just send them in as withdrawn. You're
So
not amending them.
I gotcha, but I'm still doing claims right now.
Okay, well, when I talk about
And I'm
amending
like, I'm
returns.
not going to amend the return and pay that additional tax until I know whether or not I'm going to get the money back.
Well, you're talking about the income tax return, amending the income
Yes,
tax
yes,
return.
yes, yes,
Yeah, but
yes.
you're supposed to do that.
Well, I know you are, but I haven't seen anything in that says when you're supposed to do it.
Well, within the period of the statute, I would assume.
Well, no question. No question. I'm not playing that game,
Yeah.
but I just hesitate to file that amended return, pay that additional tax, because they may deny, my claims for refund on the 941
Yeah,
extras.
now they certainly may deny it. Yep.
You know what I mean? And I was just
I'm
I
with
heard
you.
you say that, and that just caught my ear, and I was just like, what's your thoughts on that? You think that when you send those 941 X's in, you should amend the return at that point and pay that additional tax?
I personally think you should, yeah.
Okay,
Should,
fair
which
enough.
is the most worthless word in the English language, by the way, should.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. I'm just curious on your opinion or anybody else's opinion. And then one last thing, and I'm going to shut up. I've taken too much. Substantially distressed business. If we got somebody in the group here you had mentioned that has worked that and knows that, I'm going to look that up, but I'm not familiar with it. If somebody could maybe give me a call or something, give me the cliff notes on that.
Yeah, I can do that, Jim. If you go back and look at the defense conference outlines for let's see, 2023, I think I did in my
22.
ERC section in 2023, I talked about, I most definitely had it in the outlines for 2022, what a financially distressed business is. It's
Is it a percentage of gross? Is it a
percentage of gross.
monetary
Yeah,
thing?
your gross revenue had to drop by 90%. During the quarter in question to be financially distressed. A couple of other rules too that I can't think of off the top of my head, but the key one is drop in gross revenue by 90%.
Oh, so that's extreme. Okay.
Yeah, it's extreme. Yep, no
Yeah,
question.
gotcha. All right.
Okay, Dan, you have a question from Ken Eckner. For a collection company with clients who have been closed by a government order, can the collection company assert that their supply chain was closed so that they are eligible to obtain the ERTC?
Well, in order for these supply chain arguments to work, then you can't have the ability to get necessary products, materials for your business from another source. No ability to get it from another source. I strongly encourage you to look at the chief counsel memorandum. And I got the citation in the outline there as to what that memo is. And so look that up and read that. If there is the possibility of getting supplies and materials from another source, then you don't have a supply chain interruption.
Dang, man, just know that.
The other question she had was one more question. Under the voluntary disclosure program, you stated that the client must relinquish all ERTC. However, is that based upon all periods, or is that determined by period for ERTC claimed? And Ken, Larry did answer, he's pretty sure it's by a question by question analysis, which Larry did leave.
Yeah, it's quarter by quarter analysis. Yes, no doubt. Yeah, you can be eligible for one quarter and not for another.
Okay, that's all the questions there are in the chats anyways.
Okay, anybody else have a live question? Does anybody want to raise their hand and...
Oh, we got another message. Let's see who it is. If the client is close to the statute expiring and chooses to amend their income tax return, can they keep the statute of limitations open until they receive a refund by doing a protected claim?
You can always protect your, you can always do a protected claim.
I am going to say then, that's about it. Well, thank you all that came.
Wait, Chris Churchwell, did you raise
your hand? Oh, Chris got one?
Or is he waiting? I just want to add to what Jim said, that we're not filing the amended income tax returns until the client actually gets the money.
Okay.
Just as a procedural matter, because obviously we get too much backlash on that, where they're paying out some more taxes on money they never received.
Yeah, so, I get it.
Yeah. So, okay. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Chris. Anybody else?
Can you hear me?
Go ahead, Ken.
Ken, yeah.
Here's my question. Back to my collection agency. I heard what you said, that you cannot, if you cannot get the same type of supply from somebody else. But how do you define same type of supply in this case? Because it's client specific who might do a particular type of collection business where my client can't seem to get that business from somebody else. That's my dilemma. It's not a physical piece of
equipment. Well, yeah, and I understand the distinction here. And the only thing I can tell you is this IRM talks specifically about supplies. And the section in the notice from 2021-20, section 3D, Q&A 12, specifically talks about supplies of critical goods or materials necessary in the production chain of the employer, right? So if you're not talking about critical goods or materials, I don't know that you have a supply chain issue.
I don't know that. I'm trying to find the definition of...
Well, I would encourage you to read the council memo very carefully and see if you come to a different conclusion than I came to.
The reason why I'm asserting it is because goods supplies can be defined as a list of clients. It's goods and supplies, you know, on the UCC. So that's why I'm having a hard time. You're saying physical goods or supplies.
Thanks, Ken. Well, I'm going to move that along. There's one answer to follow up on contingency fees allowed under the Circular 220, only allowable if based on government ruling, but not via formulatic calculation. Dan, I'll have you look at that. Guys, I am going to have to shut this down at 1:30. I know he has an important call coming in. So, Dan, you want to...
All right. Does anybody have any final remarks? Ken, I would just encourage you to read this memo, because it's just very clearly talking about critical goods and materials. And that's the phrase that's used throughout it. All right. Thanks for your time and attention, everybody. I hope this was beneficial for you. Obviously, this is something that's developing here, and we'll be talking about it more as we go on. So happy New Year, everybody, and God bless all of you. We'll see you all soon.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Dan. Happy New Year. Appreciate it.